Okay, it's 9 o'clock on my screen, so we will get started right now. There's a few things I want to do before we turn to continue with Rabbi Yosef Mesas. Let me get his picture up here. I've been holding off on a few things because in the interest of time, so now that we have a few minutes, a number of you sent me things. I'll take 10 minutes and I'll get to some of these things with... Many of you will probably find interesting. First of all, well, one of you sent me, apparently there's a big dispute in Israel about these things that go along the hot dogs, outside the hot dogs, that plastic stuff that goes around them. Big argument between Rav Avadya Yosef and others whether it's kosher because they're made of pigskin. So that gets to the issue we dealt with about gelatin. Someone sent me last week, Rav Avadya Yosef, who appeared in all the newspapers, a new book of his on the laws of mourning came out, Avelos, and he ruled that you can do a Hail Malei Rachamim, which is like a remembrance in Shul for a non-Jewish soldier, a Jewish soldier is killed in the Israeli army. Some of you will find that interesting. Now I just want to spend a few minutes talking about this book I mentioned that came out, The Letters of Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, just because we spent 5 classes on Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski last semester, and I just want to call your attention to some interesting material that appeared in this book, which really rounds out our portrait. Actually, before I even get to that, there's an auction catalog that appeared over the summer. And one of the things they were selling was a letter from the rabbis of Aleppo, Syria, from 1928. There was a dispute about how to educate their children. And they send the letter to Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, asking him to decide. Now, I knew that Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski had a great deal of influence, but I never imagined that rabbis from Syria would be consulting him. Okay, let me just quickly go through some material in this book, which is relevant to what we spoke about. On page 63, there's an interesting story here he told from Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner, Yitzhak Huttner, was with Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, and they were talking about a strange psak of the Mishnah Brura that says that even though the halacha is, it appears in the Mishnah and the Shulchan Aruch, that you can pray in any language you want. The Mishnah Brura writes that only applies if the language you're praying in is the language from the area you're living in. That's in, for those who want to check it, it's 62 Sif Bet. It's only if that's the Safa Muhammad Uberet. So both Rav Chaim Moshe and Rav Huttner didn't understand what's going on here. Where does he get this from? And it describes how Rav Huttner went to the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim himself acknowledged that he doesn't know why he wrote this. At the time, it didn't make sense to him. He was asked, but he said that he recalled that when he studied the halacha, he went into it in great detail, and that was his conclusion. And based upon this, Rav Chaim Moshe reported that even though it appears strange to us, and we have all sorts of questions on this, and the Chafetz Chaim cannot even explain now why he came to this conclusion, since he tells us that he remembers that when he did study it, that was his conclusion. That's enough of a reason to follow this law. On page 71, it deals with the issue we spoke about. This comes from Rabbi Kahaneman of the Rosh Yeshiva Ponevezh, and it repeats, remember we discussed the issue of the stunning animals in Germany, and how Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski refused to give his reason as to why he forbid it. And here you have, again, a report where he was asked this by the German Orthodox. They weren't rejecting his psak, but they wanted to understand it. And Rav Chaim Moshe replied, no, he cannot explain the reason. I think we understand why. Because if he explained the reason, first of all, it might not have been the strongest halachic reason, and the real reason for him forbidding this was because he was afraid it might lead to other problems, and they might have not found this compelling. On page 79, He's asked, it talks about how Rav Chaim Lozer Grudzinski, well, first of all, he was asked, could you threaten a non-Shomer Shabbos person? In Vilna, I guess they're speaking about that you're not going to buy in his store if unless he closes it on Shabbos. And Rav Chaim Lozer Grudzinski replied that you're allowed to threaten him that you're going to do this, but it's questionable whether you can actually do this. And then he asked, are you allowed to look at a woman when you speak to her? And his answer, strange question you might say, but not today, if you know what's going on in the Haredi world. I've written about this. And his reply is that unless you're that sort of person who feels that you'll be driven to all sorts of sexual thoughts, yes, you can look at her. On page 118, you have also something which I did not know about. Apparently, after Rav Naftali Trop, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Chavetz Chaim's Yeshiva in Radin, after he died, his sons wanted to become Ramim. They wanted to be lecturers at the Yeshiva, and the Yeshiva didn't want to let them because they didn't have enough money or for whatever other reason, and they brought them to Beis Din. So here you have evidence, and this is the letter from the Chavetz Chaim to Chaim Moser Grudzinski discussing this. So let me remind everyone, please don't touch any of the buttons. They forgot to make only me the presenter, which means that everyone is able to play around with these buttons here. So even though it looks interesting, please just let me be the only one to do this. And tech support, I can play with it. I can get it back to the level I wanted. So we see from here that even the Holy Chafetz Chaim had to deal with challenges to his authority in the yeshiva by other Lithuanian rabbani. On page 195, you have a letter from the Agudas Rabbanim of America and also of the rabbis, including Chaim Moser Grudzinski, the leading rabbis in Europe and Lithuania. Many people are of the opinion that this is an American notion, really, from the Rabbi Soloveitchik, that if you don't have a choice, if the synagogue you can go to is one without a machitza, that you should stay home. Soloveitchik is famous for saying that, and we saw already the Rabbi Henkin disagreed. He thought that there'd be room to permit going to a synagogue which didn't have a machitza if that was the only synagogue. Here we have letters from the Agudas Rabbanim. This goes back to the mid-1920s. Agudas Rabbanim in America saying that it's forbidden, and also the Rav Chaim Lozer Grudzinski and the other rabbis saying the same thing from 1926, that if the American rabbis from 1920 and reaffirmed in 1926 by the Lithuanian rabbis that if the only synagogue you can go to is one without a machitza, rather pray by yourself. And this is signed by also the Chafetz Chaim and the Kovno Rav. On page 232, you have another one of the letters dealing with the transfer of the rabbinical seminary to the land of Israel that we spoke so much about, and we see again Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski's great opposition to German culture. He refers to it as HaKultur HaAshkenazi Shehachriv et Kol HaOlam, German culture that's destroyed the entire world, and that we have to do everything to stop the rabbinical seminary of Berlin coming to the land of Israel. Later on, we see letters which deals with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, role in Agudas Yisrael. On page 274, we see that there were people who were afraid that by telling the Germans that we don't want your rabbinical seminary, that they would take offense. It's as if we're saying that we don't want you. And Rav Chaim Moser says, no, that's not true. We have a lot of respect for the German Jews. We just don't want their rabbinical seminary. A few more things of on page 283, we see that at least some people on Agudas Yisrael, this is sent to a Mr. or maybe he's a Rabbi Eyes in Zurich, Switzerland, who was a leading Agudas Yisrael functionary. And we see from this letter that Eyes, and I guess other Aguda figures, this is from 1936, they wanted to make a special deal with the Arabs. That is, Agudas Yisrael should try to make a modus vivendi with the Arabs in the land of Israel, try to make some sort of deal. And this isn't the first time that the right wing would do this, although actually during the War of Independence, I have a letter I've never published from the extreme Eda Haredit, even more extreme, more than the Troikarta types, in which they sent a letter to the Arab authorities as telling them exactly who they are, how many of them there are, basically so they're not killed if the Arabs win. The Prime Ozer Grozinski's letter response is very strong. He says this is in opposition to my viewpoint. He says that I am very, very opposed to this, and the martyrs of Hebron show this, that the Arabs don't distinguish between yeshiva people, aguda people, non-aguda people. As so a strong rejection of this idea that some in aguda were floating, that this has always been a segment of aguda, at least there used to be, before the state was formed, that thought that we should really make peace with the Arabs and not have a united front. Jacob Dahan, was one of the aguda people in the land of Israel, later assassinated by the Zionists, by the predecessors of the Haganah. He was assassinated precisely because he was meeting with Arab leaders. He was publishing anti-Zionist propaganda. This was not the approach of the Aguda in Europe. But as we've spoken about already, the Aguda in the land of Israel was really the anti-Zionist segment. And many of them would have had no difficulty at all making an agreement with the Arabs and selling out the Zionists. And we see what Chaim Ozer replies here. Later on, this volume, on page 284, we see, writes to Rabbi Reuven Katz, who is the Rav of Petach Tikva. They were very afraid the Mizrahi was going to set up a yeshiva, an agricultural yeshiva, in which you'd learn, and you'd also yeshiva chakla'it. And which you'd also learn, I guess, and you'd work the land half the time. And Ephraim Ozer says that we have to shut this down, because if not, the yeshiva bachrim will leave the yeshivot, because the yeshivot, they're very suffering. There was almost starvation in some of these yeshivot. I think we see from here the same concern Ephraim Ozer had about the rabbinical seminary to the land of Israel. He says that the yeshivas will empty out. Everyone's going to want to go study in places like the rabbinical seminary. How different things are today, where there is no such concern. And yet, at this time, the only way they could keep the yeshivas functioning, they thought, was preventing an alternative. I have a couple of other things, but I'll save them for next week in the interest of time. Just one more thing I wanted to tell you. I neglected to mention this by mistake from Palmier. On page 121, he has one criticism of traditional Judaism. Let me read it to you. And he says that he's not the only one to have it. Christians who occasionally visit the Jewish temple have expressed themselves to me more than once in the same way. The Jewish ceremony has eloquence for them, but the effort at verbal translation has none of it. And I understand the deeper lying reasons of the Orthodox of other days against the introduction of preaching in the common tongue, the vernacular. In synagogue worship, it seems like an hors d'oeuvre and is the concession of doubtful value to the customs of other cults. He's saying that this idea of a sermon just doesn't work, and he's opposed to the sermon synagogue. What do you mean he's opposed to the sermon in the synagogue? Palmier is very attracted to the davening, but not the sermon. I don't know how many of you realize this, but the sermon is a modern invention. It goes back to the 18th century. It comes from the Christian world, originates in Germany. In traditional European society, there were no sermons. There were magidim, who spoke on Shabbos afternoon sometimes, but they did not have sermons. They would, if you ever read traditional drushos, it's full of citations of the Talmud and Midrash, and the Rav of the community would never preach. He would give halachic drashot a couple times a year. What is the modern sermon, which arises in Germany? And sermon really hasn't changed much in 150 years. Listen next time you're in synagogue to the sermon, which we get every week. The rabbi will never get up and rate, or I should say never, maybe some of you are going to write in and say, in your synagogue, he does this. But the rabbi will never, in my experience, get up and raise a problem. There's a problem in the Torah portion. In this pasuk it says X, in that pasuk it says Y. This seems to be a contradiction. Here's a way we can explain the contradiction. Here, you will hear divrei Torah like this at college minyanim, sometimes at places where there is no rabbi, and you have the lay people giving the sermon. That's not how the rabbi's sermon is. Rabbi's sermon follows the Christian Protestant model of the 19th century, where the stress was on the special word edification. What is edify? To edify means to improve spiritually. That's why all the sermons we hear always have a message, a spiritual edification. In fact, they often end by the rabbi saying something like, and we should all be zoche to have this in our life. Listen to the sermons. They all try to get a spiritual message, to try to improve you morally. That's the Protestant sermon. It is not traditional. It is standard today, so much so that if the rabbi were to get up and simply do what I suggested, would be the traditional Dvar Torah, namely raise a problem in the text and answer it, people would think that's very strange. I think we take it for granted, the sermon, that it's supposed to be edifying. However, we see that Palmier, he looked upon it as an import from the Christians, a foreign cult, and he says he understands why the old-time Orthodox were opposed to it, because he didn't see it as fitting the mode of the synagogue. I have to say that I don't really see this objection. I mean, maybe I'm so used to it that it feels normal. But maybe if you've davened your whole life in shtiebels, Hasidic davenings, and you come to the modern Orthodox service, and all of a sudden, between Shachris and Musaf, you get a display of rhetoric, of homiletics, of preaching, maybe it'll appear strange to you. But that's Palmier. Okay, and now let's... Oh, one more thing. Barak from Australia emailed me to let me know that there was a Farmbrengen in Melbourne last week for Yud Tes Kislev, and there was a speaker from the United States, and his whole drusha was about how Lubavitch should focus their efforts on teaching the B'nai Noach about their obligations, and how the Lubavitch have now written a Shulchan Aruch for non-Jews. That's relevant to the Ben HaMosev lectures. Okay, let's pick up now, return to what we've been doing. The fascinating, amazing figure of Rav Yosef Mesas. Let me point out, I couldn't figure it out last class. Couple more seconds, and I didn't want to take the time, but here it is, the date, which I was trying to figure out. If you look over here, the reason I couldn't figure it out, whenever you have dates like this, this is from a verse, or right around this season of year, whatever is enlarged, that's what you have to add up the numerical value. But the hay here, actually you have to add up the value of the tetragrammaton. So it's good hay and then vav hay, and then you'll get to 1934. This is the first volume of Rav Mesas's responsa. And if you look at just let you take a look at this also, a lot of the Sephardic rabbis, they would in their title page would have a very Melitzedek formulation. There's 314 tshuvot, Otzar Shaddai tshuvot. And it goes on, Pnuyoto Adnei Orach Mitzavot, Rishimim Amaroto wrote. It's a rhyming, and a lot of them would do things like that. We ended last class, really we ended last class about his view on women covering their hair, but I went through in detail his psak about non-kosher beliefs. And I said just briefly that he felt that there was room to permit not non-kosher butchers, non-shomer Shabbos butchers, rely on them kosheris. And I said briefly that he proved, based upon our Rishon, that there's room to be lenient. So someone asked me to elaborate, so let me just briefly mention, there is a view in the work called the Itter, which is a medieval text that says that when they speak about a Machal Shabbos as being equivalent to an idolater, you need two things. First of all, you need public, which these butchers did have. but you also need a violation of Shabbos, which is involves what he calls avodat karka, some violation of Shabbos, agriculture violation of Shabbos, just violating some other of the 39 labors. That's not enough, but you need to be doing something with the land. And he proves this in certain ways. The other Rishonim don't accept that, but Rabbi Nessa says, in this circumstance, we can rely on the Itcher. Now, I went through his argument saying that in today's day and age, there is no longer an obligation for women, married women to cover their hair. And I said that this is a limud zchut, a finding of a justification. In fact, as I said, the responsa begins that so many rabbis and shochtim, their wives should not cover their hair. Now, this notion of limud zchut, finding a justification for questionable practices, has a very long history in Judaism. And the justification is brought about precisely because, as Mesa says, pious people do things. You often have this in all sorts of areas, examples of practices that appear to be against halacha, appear to be against the book halacha, and yet since so many pious people are doing it, the rabbis argue there must, at least some rabbis will argue, there must be some justification, and that's called limud zchus, chadash, not eating the new grains is one of the most famous, but there's loads and loads of these examples. Because there has always been a tension between the desire to follow the halacha as found in the books, and the competing desire to justify widespread behavior. One of Chaim Soloveitchik's points in his article, Rupture and Reconstruction, everyone speaks about chumras, chumras this, chumras that. The truth of the matter is that a lot of these so-called chumras are not really chumras. When I say they're not chumras, it's not like you have a mainstream halacha, and then you have some crazy viewpoint which no one ever followed by some individual authority, and the Haredim or the people today have discovered this and are now pushing it for a chumrah. For almost all of these so-called chumrahs, that's not it at all. It's that these texts, these stringencies are found in the classic sources, found in the standard works. It's just that for a long time, they were ignored. And it's actually the practice that we are doing now, the mainstream practice, that's the problematic practice. It's just that this has been the practice for so long. Take Glatt Kosher, for example. Glatt Kosher is not some crazy chora. Glatt Kosher is a mainstream halacha, which wasn't the general practice in Europe. But no one ever said that if you have an opportunity to eat Glatt Kosher, you shouldn't, or at least most people didn't. Some thought that it was a waste of Jewish. The idea that this is some chumrah that someone found and in some unusual source, it's not the case. And it's not the case with almost all of these. What makes them seem so novel is precisely because there's been a tradition to rely on Minhag Yisrael. And Minhag Yisrael often is in tension with the book tradition. What's novel, and this is what Soloveitchik, the point of his article, is that today we no longer have faith in the tradition of our ancestors, and we're going back to the books. And when we go back to the books, we find, hey, you know, it turns out that a lot of the things we, you know, if you look at the book, it would seem that maybe our cups should be bigger. A kiddush. The fact that no one had such large cups, or no one had such large shiurim on Pesach, we don't care about that, because this is what the books say. And so the books do say that. So it's a chumrah in the sense that it goes against the Minhag Yisrael, but it's not a chumrah in the sense that it's some unusual stuff. Actually not, Barak. The Aruch HaShulchan does not have a limud zchus regarding women covering their hair. If the Aruch HaShulchan had such a limud zchus, finds there such a limud zchus, then the practice of women covering their hair among the young, especially the serious centrist Orthodox, never would have come back the way it has. What the Aruch HaShulchan says is that it's a terrible thing that women are not covering their hair. What can we do about it? They're not listening. And since so many of them don't listen, the other halacha, the halacha that says that you can't daven in front of a woman's hair because it's nakedness, that is no longer applicable, because today we see all the hair. No woman's hair is going to be sexually arousing. The Mishnah Berurah says it doesn't matter. It still is the halacha, even though the women don't cover their hair. And Aruch Shulchan says, no, it's not the halacha. And therefore, we can have, as Rav Moshe Feinstein says, we can have long mechitzas. It's not a problem, because look, if you have all these women, they have a little doily, we see all their hair, we wouldn't be able to have daven in our synagogues with the mechitzas. However, the Aruch Shulchan doesn't say that because all the Aruch Shulchan believes there's two halachot here. There's the halacha on the woman, has to cover her hair, and then there's the other halacha on everyone else, that they can't see nakedness. And nakedness, according to the Aruch Shulchan, depends on habituality, how used you are to it. And therefore, since you see it all the time, it's not regarded nakedness by us. But according to the Aruch Shulchan, that doesn't change the fact that the woman still has an obligation to cover her hair. In fact, the Askilavdi, Rav Avadya Hedaya, says that, let's say you're in a place like Africa, are accustomed to go about bare-breasted, you're with the natives, then the bare-breasted will no longer be nakedness, and you can daven in front of it. However, you are correct, Barak, that the justification of the Aruch HaShulchan, that is this logic, that it's no longer nakedness, that was used not just by the Rav Yosef Messas, but this was the justification of Rabbi Broid in his article, and it appears to have been the feeling of many Lithuanian rabbis. They didn't think that head covering was such a big deal. Only a few of those have actually appeared in print. But if you speak to the old rabbis, they either thought it was a chumrah or not such a big deal, and they seem to think that nakedness sole criterion, and that if it's no longer regarded as nakedness, then the woman herself is not obligated in this. But almost all of the written responses that deal with this issue specifically reject this justification and say there are two separate halachot here. The halacha that permits us davening in front of an uncovered hair is separate from the halacha upon the woman that she has to cover her hair. And that is found, as I said, in almost all the sources that discuss it. So unless you were saying exactly what I said, Barak, I don't think so. I think that your point was that Aruch HaShulchan is often quoted as saying that he permits women to go with uncovered hair. He doesn't. Now, we don't have the entire Aruch HaShulchan and Eben HaEzer, but if you look in the part we do have, he has an opportunity to say this. He doesn't. Had the Aruch HaShulchan said this, the Aruch HaShulchan gives many limud zchus, gives many justifications. He was the first one to justify davening in front of women uncovering their hair. That perhaps was as far as he would go. But had the Aruch HaShulchan, or had Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was asked the same question, had they ruled that this isn't an obligation in an era when most women don't cover their hair, then it would have gone out, no question, it would have gone out of style. But they didn't rule that. They ruled that it was halacha, and with the return to the book tradition in the late 1970s and 1980s, a hair covering then became de rigueur. I don't think even 1 or 2% of the rabbis graduating reads in the 1950s that their wives covered their hair. And why shouldn't they have? If their Rebbe, the Rav's wife, didn't cover her hair, and with the exception of Rav Yosef Weiss and Rav David Lifshitz, I don't think any of the other Rosh Yeshivat reads covered their hair. Certainly they were not makpid on it. Maybe when it went outside, some of them put a hat on, but in terms of wearing shadels, it was almost unheard of in the Lithuanian, not just at Reitz, at Ner Yisrael and at other yeshivas also. Compare that to today, where I think every single one of the musmachim, their wives cover their hair. So there's been a big change in that area. Look, if you go back to the 1950s, many of the shuls also had dinner dances, and you won't find many of them today. So, as I said, there is this tension between the book tradition and the practice of the masses, practice of the community. When I say tradition, I'm not referring to The irreligious, I'm referring to those who are generally observant. And in the Sephardic community, in which there's a wide, much wider range of observance than in the Ashkenazic world, and all these people associate with the traditional synagogue, but what is regarded as the practice of the masses is much wider. So rabbis like Rabbi Mesas had a sense of responsibility for those Jews and would often bend over backwards to justify their practices, to show that they don't go against Torah or rabbinic law. Some felt that he bent over so much that he even fell backwards, not just bent backwards. And this is why Rav Avadya Yosef, although in his early volumes he quotes Rav Yosef Mesas and quotes him like he quotes any other authority, in his more recent writings, especially when after Rav Yosef Mesas, the second volume of his Mayim Chayim, I'll show it to you here. I'll be quoting from some in a little while. The second volume of Responsa, Mayim Chayim, this appeared in 1985. Now, subsequent to that, Rav Avadya Yosef says that you cannot rely on Rav Yosef Mesas' rulings. They're only good for testifying to what practices were, what other great sages says, and maybe to offer a svara. But in terms of practical halakha, he says you don't rely on it. But Rav Moshe Malka, who was the chief rabbi of Petah Tikva, he says that anyone who says this, well, will have to account for it in the future, that is after death. In other words, they've sinned against the learned Rabbi Mesas. Without question, the most radical of Mesas' attempts at Limud Sukkot relates to Shabbos observance. Now, while I'm telling you about, I'm starting with his halachic innovations, and then we'll get into other areas, because bear in your mind how we would regard such a rabbi if he was in the United States and said something like this. He obviously would not be regarded as a traditional rabbi. He'd be out of the fold. I don't know what else we'd say about him, but and yet, look who we're talking about here. Here's a picture of Rav Yosef Mesas, chief rabbi of Haifa. Look how he's described. I read this description. If you read Hebrew, you'll see that these are the descriptions of great Torah sages. So try to think to yourself, and then we'll reflect on this. What society is it that could produce a figure who is so much a part of the rabbinic elite in his homeland, who to this day is regarded as an important posek? Certainly the Moroccans regard him as an important posek. Rav Avadya Yosef's opinion is really out of the mainstream by saying you don't rely on his psak. And in his lifetime, he obviously was an important rav, as I said, chief rabbi of Haifa. And yet he could come up with such psakim that if it took place in America, we would assume he's a conservative rabbi. We wouldn't even say that he's a left-wing Orthodox rabbi. It just shows you that halakha has so many options in it that if you're in a society where you're not concerned about conservative reform, and if you're an independent thinker, you can come up with all sorts of new ideas and still be within the fold of traditional Judaism. And for those who are interested, look on HebrewBooks.org or the other sites, open up his responsa, see his godlessness, see how much he knows. You know, a bucky and all of Shas and Poskim. We'll read together a few of them in a little while. So the issue, when I say Shabbos observance, was as follows. In Tlemcen, Algeria, in the 1920s and the 1930s, the average person was carrying on Shabbos. I don't think it's any different than what was going on in the United States. The first era of establishing the United States is in the 19th century in St. Louis, and then the turn of the century, there was an era of establishing the Lower East Side. And until the 1970s, I don't believe there was another Erev in the United States. Correct me if I'm wrong. I remember when the Erev went up in my town in West Orange, New Jersey. We had Orthodox Jews in West Orange. We had Orthodox Jews in every city in America. And yet there was no Erev. Baby carriages were pushed on Shabbos, carried palaces on Shabbos. They went to people's houses on Shabbos. When they had sukkahs came on Shabbos, they carried the food out there. They carried their keys on Shabbos. The very from, those who were makpid, medakdeg, you might remember, those who were old enough, they had special keychains, that key things, ties, this put your tie, it would be shaped like your key for the house, or you'd hide the key under the mat, but most people did not do that. And there was no pressure for an eitrav. In the 1950s and 60s and 70s, early 70s at least, people, the Orthodox community was not saying we need an eitrav. It's only when my generation, those of us who were, went to day school beginning in the early 1970s, that we started learning the laws of Hilchos Shabbos, and we began to get older, that people began insisting that, you know, we need an eitrav. There was an eitrav in Europe, you had eitrav, and that we need an eitrav in America, because people now were taking Shabbos much more seriously. So in Algeria, you didn't have eitrav. All these people to be regarded as Mechalei Shabbos, carrying things. Yes, the Toronto Eruv, you're right. Toronto Eruv is the third Eruv in North America established by Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart. We should have a class or two on him, a great posek in Toronto, a Mizrahi Rav, a Rav who left a memoir full of great stuff. He established an Eruv in Toronto. Other than that, the rabbis wouldn't have been able to. The people were not interested. They weren't going to fund it. So it's unique, and when you think about it, the fact that you didn't have Eruv in all these cities, it was because, as I said, for the most part, the so-called Orthodox Jews were not very observant. They were not very educated. And but with the creation of day schools, and that's why we really have to give them a lot of credit. You have people today look back at 1950s Orthodoxy, they make fun of it, you know, these were not serious people, they were not learned, and yet these were the people who sacrificed, first of all, even if they were not so observant in their personal life, they sacrificed for the Orthodox community, they were the ones who built the day schools, they were the ones who fought to keep the synagogues Orthodox, even if they themselves were not Orthodox, they were the ones who sacrificed financially to send us, their children, to day schools, and many of them were then brought along with their children, so that today you have something you never had in the 1950s and 60s. You have communities. I mean, you still have communities, especially out west, where you have non-observant Orthodox. Go to places like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and you have complete communities with hundreds of families where everyone is Shomer Shabbos. It's an amazing thing. So what did Rabbi Messas say about Clemson? First of all, let's not forget, this isn't a biblical prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition, for the most part, because we're not dealing with big cities. He attempted an amazing justification of the people who were carrying on Shabbos, so that they not be regarded as sinners. And he tells us that this justification was also shared by one of his predecessors in Tlemcen, Rabbi Chaim Belia was his name, who is a very well-known Moroccan Algerian rabbi from the 19th century, not a liberal by any means. Rabbi Messas argues, and Rabbi Belia argued in the 19th century, or he died in 1919, so it's the 20th century, that in today's day and age, there is no need for an Eruv in order to be able to carry on Shabbos. Now, to say that this is a radical position is an understatement, since the laws of Eruv are found in all of the standard codes from medieval times until Rabbi Messas' day. And no one had ever suggested such a thing, although he tells us that Rabbi Belia suggested that, but we just have his word for it. We don't have a response from Rabbi Belia, but Rabbi Messas, I mean, we have his writings. And this comes from a man, Rabbi Yosef Messas, who was a great Hebrew poet and author. He actually wrote a piyut, a pizmon, to recite when you put up the Eruv. And when he was in Haifa, he was in charge of the Eruv. And yet he argued that in today's day and age, speaking in Tlemcen, but it applies to basically all of our cities, there is no longer an obligation for an Eruv. In the words of his cousin, Rabbi Shalom Messas, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, here's his Israeli stamp I showed you the other day. We spent a few classes on him. Rabbi Shalom Messas, his cousin, has a long response about this, about his Rabbi Yosef's position, and he refers to it as nothing less than, quote, Baal Yira'a u'Baal Yematze. In other words, you cannot find such a position anywhere. It's in other words, he's saying it's outlandish. But what was Rav Nesas's argument? How did he come up with such a viewpoint? Again, you're dealing with a Gadol Yisrael, someone, a chief rabbi of Haifa, a Rav in Algeria, the leading Algerian rabbi, one of the leading Moroccan rabbis, on the base to the Meknes, one whose responses are quoted in numerous volumes of the great rabbis who write approbations, and yet he comes up with such a position? First of all, we know he was not frightened by originality. You can see this already. And he was thus willing to offer an incredible justification of the masses carrying on Shabbos. He first begins to argue. Now, we see his viewpoint based on his cousin, Rosh Hashanah Mesas's reputation, and we have a small responsum, which we see his approach. However, his lengthy responsum, which I think is about 20 pages, has not yet been published. For a long time, I was trying to get a copy of it, because I would like to publish it and discuss it. I've collected a number of responsa dealing with Erev in North Africa in the 20th century, because when I say there weren't Erevin, I'm talking about in America. In much of North Africa, you had what was known as the Mela, the ghetto where the Jews lived. That was surrounded by a wall. So in that area, you had the ability to carry. So you had discussion. It turns out that Professor Moshe Barasha, who himself is Moroccan, one of the great scholars of Hebrew language, they tell me he knows everything. He's at the Hebrew University. He has a copy of it. I saw an article he wrote about Rabbi Mesas, and he mentions that he has a copy of it. Now, I was trying to find this for years, and apparently he actually got it in Morocco, because Rabbi Mesas' son, Elia Mesas, who has published many of his father's writings, and really he knows his father's works, he did not have it. I asked Professor Barasher, and he told me that I can't have it because he is planning on publishing it. So let's hope. But he begins the argument by saying that, and this is already a discussion in the codes, the Shulchan Aruch, do we have Rosh Hashanah Rabbim today or not? And his position, which you find in many others, is that today there is no such thing as a Rosh Hashanah Rabbim. A Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, well, maybe New York City, but Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, you need 600,000 people, it needs to be a certain width. None of our cities, basically, are Rosh Hashanah Rabbim. And therefore, there is no prohibition to carry biblically. There is only a prohibition to carry rabbinically. Our cities are therefore to be regarded as a carmelis. What's a carmelis? A carmelis is it stands between a private dwelling and a public dwelling. In a private dwelling, we can carry. In a public dwelling, we can't. And in the carmelis, the rabbis forbid us to carry. He argued, that is, Rabbi Mesas argued, that since today, he apparently had this conception that in Second Temple days, there really were a good deal of public thoroughfares, because he says that today, since we have no public thoroughfare, therefore the gezeirah of the rabbis against carrying in a carmelis is no longer. If you look, the justification for a carmelis, why are we forbidden to carry in a carmelis? Mesas quotes already Rishonim say, the reason we are forbidden to carry in a carmelis, that is a rabbinic public thoroughfare, is because of a fear that we would then carry in a public thoroughfare. I don't think this means that we would be walking in the carmelis, and then we'd walk from the carmelis to the public thoroughfare. I don't think it means that. I think it means that if we become accustomed to carrying on Shabbos in a carmelis, therefore, when we're in an area that has a Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, we will also carry. We won't make the distinction. Rabbi Mesas says, since there is no Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, the rabbi's prohibition against carrying in a carmelis is no longer applicable, because the whole point of the gezeirah against carrying in a carmelis was to prevent carrying in a public thoroughfare. There no longer is a public thoroughfare. Ergo, there's no longer prohibition to carry in a carmelis. The weakness in this position is obvious, as Rabbi Shalom Esos points out. In Rambam's day, you didn't have public thoroughfares either. And he doesn't say this, and none of the poskim say this. That's what he says. And as Professor Barasher pointed out to me, and that this is all in the realm of limud zchus. This is in terms of justification of the people carrying. So this is not as if you're saying ab initio you can now carry on Shabbos. But since the people are already carrying on Shabbos, don't regard them as mechalei Shabbos. In fact, in another response, and that's printed in the Mayim Chaim, the same responsum, Rabbi Messa has two responsa about women's hair covering. He has a very long one and a shorter one. The shorter responsum on women's hair covering is together with the responsum I'm going to mention right now about carrying on Shabbos. They're one responsum, very radical. Two of his most radical positions in one responsum. The person who published this volume, his name is Shlomo Dayan. He's a Hillel in Jerusalem, a big Talmud Chacham, also Moroccan, from Tetuan, if I'm not mistaken. I have his volume of responsa, and he's always quoting Rabbi Messas. He published this volume, Mayim Chaim, Volume 2. He told me that he regrets publishing this responsum because it's so radical, not just women's hair covering, but also carrying on Shabbos. Even though we know both these positions from elsewhere, he regrets publishing it. This, of course, leads me to wonder what things did he not publish? I sense he published everything, because if you're going to censor something, these are the things that you're going to censor. Censor these two radical tshuvot. If he went so far as to publish these two, then he believed at the time that it's not his job to censor Gedolei Yisrael. I salute him for this, because we should be intellectually dishonest. It's not our job to censor Gedolei Yisrael because their positions are not politically correct or don't fit in with our Weltanschauung today. Do you know that there's a responsum by Rav Aaron Cutler in support of the Heter Mechira, of the chief rabbinate selling the land during the sabbatical year, and the family refuses to publish it? And there's other examples like this. So as I said, I salute Rabbi Dayan. Rabbi Dayan was a great Talmud Chacham, is a great Talmud Chacham, and he was a Shas deputy. After him, all of the Shas members of Knesset were simply figureheads, functionaries, bureaucrats, until Rabbi Amsalam. He's also a great Talmud Chacham, the author of something like 5 Sfarim, a great scholar. He's the one, if you've been following the news, who he's been identified now with a Malek, such a radical, a maskil, all for suggesting that unless you're a great Talmud Chacham and, I'm a Dayan or a Rav, you shouldn't spend your entire life studying at public expense, and that the Sephardic tradition always is that those people who are not said, who are not going to become the Gedolei Yisrael or the Dayanim, that after studying for a number of years, they should then get a job and make a living with kavod and set aside time for learning, like the Rambam says. And that's always been the Sephardic approach, and doesn't seem so radical. And yet, he has been vilified. He, though, is the only Shas member of Knesset today who's a rabbi. And after Rabbi Dayan, I believe he is the only one who is a Rav and a Mechaber of Sfarim. I don't think... See, that's the problem. There were public thoroughfares, because we have this discussions. Rome, other places must have public thoroughfares, but it just stands to reason that if there's no public thoroughfares in the 1930s, there certainly are no public thoroughfares in medieval times or ancient times. And unless you're going to say that the whole law is really only a theoretical halakha if you have a public thoroughfare. The problem with this is that the Rambam doesn't say this, the Torah doesn't say this, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say this. None of them say that the whole idea of karmelis only applies if you have, maybe let's say you're in the New York area, New York's a public thoroughfare, and therefore in that area you'd have it. But if you're living in Azerbaijan, there's no public thoroughfares, then you don't have the gezeirah of karmelis. But no one ever says that. Everyone assumes that if it's not a public thoroughfare and it's not a private dwelling, by definition it is a public thoroughfare. It is a karmelis. And Rabbi Messa says, no, it's not a karmelis unless there's a public thoroughfare. In his responsum, though, in the Mayim Chayim, he doesn't go this far. In fact, he says explicitly that we don't permit carrying in public thoroughfares. So it seems that he backtracked a bit from his responsum in Tlemcen. Or I guess it appears it's a different era, because that the responsum is later. He's writing it to, in 1955, this is written. So already in 1955 in Meknes, he is saying halacha l'maisa that we don't carry in a public thoroughfare. However, he says something else interesting. He was asked about an Eruv Chaseros. This idea that if we have, in Morocco they have a lot of these. You have these dwellings, apartments, that then have a courtyard that's surrounded by all of the dwellings, and you have an inner courtyard. We're not allowed to carry in there on Shabbos unless we do what's called an Eruv Chaseros that makes it into a single domain. So again, if you look at the reasons, why do you need an Eruv Chaseros? The reason you need an Eruv Chaseros is because you might carry from there, from that this sort of semi-private dwelling, you might carry from there into a public thoroughfare. And Rabbi Messas says, well, since we don't have public thoroughfares anymore, then there's no gezeira of Eruv Chaseros anymore. He says it's enough that we don't carry outside in the Carmelis. But there's no gezeira not to carry from an Eruv from a semi-public private area into a Carmelis. Gezeira is only not to carry from a semi-private to a Rishus HaRabim. But if outside the semi-private you have a Carmelis, you don't need to do a an Eruv Chaseros. So here you have the Diet of Meknes. A Maisa telling someone in Tangier that you don't need to do Eruv Chaseros. And for that very reason. Also, quite radical. I know of, this is not as radical, obviously, as saying you can just carry on the street on Shabbos. But still, I don't know of anyone else who argues that in today's day and age, there is no longer obligation for an Eruv Chaseros. On the contrary, the assumption is that, of course, you need an Eruv Chaseros. And all the poskim discuss, well, let's say you go to college. I remember when we were in college, they told us we didn't need an Eruv Chaseros because we didn't own the beds. Think of a hotel, you don't own them. But if you're in a regular apartment building, people assume you can just carry in the lobby. It's not, you can't. Hotel is different, but if you rent your apartment, if you own your apartment, it's a different situation. We all assume you do need an Eruv Chaseros, but he thought differently. Other radical tshuvot of his. He was asked about alcohol, which contained wine, non-kosher wine, kosher wine, but it had been handled by Muslims. So you have alcohol, which wine is mixed in it, I don't know what you call it, was that cognac, I'm not sure, and it's handled by Muslims. Here, he is not the only one with a radical viewpoint. He quotes a responsum by an earlier Moroccan rabbi, even permitted drinking wine that non-Muslims handled. Messas didn't go this far. Part of his heter, and you can see it's a long responsum, is a combination of various, what we call snifim, various factors. One of them is that it's not actual wine, but it's wine mixed with alcohol. But he concludes by quoting this earlier rabbi who permitted actually drinking the wine, Muslims, there is no unity of God like the unity found in Islam. Therefore, one who forbids them to handle wine turns holy into profane by regarding worshippers of God as worshippers of idols, God forbid. In other words, the argument is that Muslims are not idolaters, they are monotheists, therefore there is no mention of Yei Nesach. Yes, there is a concept found in at least the Ashkenazic Rishonim that even if we're not afraid of them using the wine and their idolatrous rites, there's still another reason for the decree to prevent intermarriage, Mishum Banos, but that's just a view mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, by the Tosafists. It's not found in the Sephardic poskim. It's not even found in all the Ashkenazic poskim. In the main view of Stam Yenam, just plain wine, is the fear that they would use it for libations. Look at the conservative responsum that permitted non-kosher wine. That's the justification they use. But today we know they don't use it for libations. So Rabbi Messas, though, has a question, a problem. What about the rule? We have a rule, and if there is a rabbinic decree, this is found, and you find this in the Rambam and elsewhere, if there is a reason for a rabbinic decree, and it's the reason is no longer applicable, it still applies. If the rabbis made a gezeira, and the reason for the gezeira is no longer applicable, the decree still applies. Truthfully, that's only some people say this. Other people say it doesn't apply. Those of us who don't wash mayim acharonim, we rely on the Tosfot that say we don't have the special type of salt that would be dangerous to your eyes. Therefore, we don't need to do mayim acharonim. Or if we dance today on Shabbos, the Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to dance on Shabbos because we're afraid we're going to fix an instrument. But if we don't have, if that's not the circumstances today, we can dance. But the other poskim say out differently. Sephardic poskim, though, however, the Rambam, they assume that even if the reason doesn't apply, the prohibition still applies, and therefore Avad Yosef says you can't dance on Shabbos. Melach Sodomis. So Rav Messas has to deal with this. What is his answer? Well, first, before getting to his answer, I'll tell you, he doesn't just permit Gentile wine, he permits Gentile cooking. Bishalakum. Bishalakum, the reason is obvious. The reason is explicit that is not because of libations, but because it's a way of preventing Jews and Gentiles from mixing closely so that this will lead to intermarriage. How you understand the reason for this, and whether you think that the gezeirot of the sages can change based upon the reason, will determine how far you take this prohibition. I just told you the reason given in the early sources is bishalakum is to prevent us from getting too chummy with the non-Jews. And yes, there are ways you can get around it by the Jew lighting the fire, but still, the basic reason is that we don't intermarry. So if that's the reason, it would make sense, as some poskim have argued, that there is no notion of bishalakum in factory-produced goods. Because I can understand if my neighbor, the woman who lives next door to me, the man who lives next door to me, the non-Jew, cooks for me, I'd be going hanging out at his house. He's cooking not kosher food. He has a nice daughter. I end up getting married. However, if a factory is cooking, non-Jews are cooking, what connection does that have to me? There's no way that this will possibly lead to any intermarriage. And therefore, some have argued that there's the whole notion of bishalakum doesn't apply to factories. This is not the mainstream position. I know, for example, the OU, they insist that even in factories, they turn it on and off. The Raivad argues that for servants, maids, there's no bishalakum with them because we're not on an equal footing. There's no fear that I'm going to marry my maid. Maybe today there would be the fear, but the Raivad in his society, there never would be such a fear. If you're going to marry a non-Jew, it's going to be one of the elites. It's not going to be one of these poor peasants who come to work for you. And this is the heter that's given, by the way. And I was told this halacha l'maisa. I don't know if I should mention his name, because maybe he doesn't want this, but a responsible posek. People and anyone who has children and has some money, they have au pairs, or they have babysitters, and these babysitters are cooking all the time. They're cooking for the children. Sometimes they're cooking for the parents also. Is this bishalakum? If it's bishalakum, you can't eat it. Not only can't you eat it, the utensils will be treif. Certainly as a limud schus, this posek who told it to me, did not tell it to me l'charchila, he told it to me as a limud schus that you can rely on the raivad, who says that basically your workers, you don't have to be afraid of bishalakum. Because I tell you that you take a town like mine, or probably everyone listening here, of the people who have a babysitter, 99% of the people have the babysitter cooking. And these days, how many people even have a pilot light? You have these electric starter stoves. So and there's no way you're going to get people that babysitters that they're going to have not going to have them cook, that they're going to have to light the stove or do things like this for them. And therefore, you have the Raivad. Raivad holds that if it's a worker, there's no bishalakum. The problem, which is the Rav pointed out to me, was that if you read the Raivad, the discussion of the Raivads, it seems to be saying, if I recall correctly, that you're sort of there with the person. So therefore, if I'm in the house and the non-Jew is cooking, I'm walking back and forth. It's like I'm a mashgiach, as it were. There's not going to be any problems. I'm not going to use treif. I'm the boss. So in those circumstances, but if I'm not home, it could be more problematic. Although I still am the boss, it could be more problematic. In any event, he did give me a heter, in which he said that you can rely on the Raivad, because, as I said, pretty much everyone you meet, they have non-Jewish workers. How many of them actually have the Jew light the stove? It's all doing bishalakum, and if you don't rely on the Raivad, I don't know what you would do. But once you assume, let's go for two more minutes, that if you have a gezeira, and the Sephardic rabbis, the Sephardic halachic authorities taught that once the gezeira is binding, even if it's not applicable, what do you do? The Rabbi Mesa says there's a way out of it. He says this only applies if there is a situation. For example, let's say Mayim Acharonim. We have to use Mayim Acharonim because there's this thing, Mayim Sodomis. This salt that could hurt our eyes. But if we don't have the salt in our area, so the Tosafot says we don't have to be concerned about it. But the other post would say, no, you do need to be concerned about it. Rabbi Mesa says this: you'd only need to be concerned about it if it was somehow possible that you'd still be with Mayim Melech Sodomis. If you could go to a country where you would have this. But if there's no Melech Sodomis in the entire world, it doesn't exist at all, then according to everyone, the gezeira would no longer be applicable. You wouldn't need to do it. He says the same thing applies to the concern over venomous snakes. We're not concerned about leaving. No venomous snakes at all, that you wouldn't be concerned about a cup without a top on it, where the Talmud says you can't drink from it. And he says that there's no reason to think that idolatry, that is the old type of idolatry that the sages of the Talmud spoke against, is ever going to return into this world. And we'll see what he says about Christianity. He does not think Christianity is that form of idolatry. He says idolatry has been wiped away. Either Islam or Christianity, it will never again come into our world. And he doesn't speak about Africa, but I think his answer would be, don't tell me about Africa. Africa is being colonized. There's no chance at all that in the Jewish world you're ever going to have a situation where African paganism is going to enter. And Hinduism also isn't a concern, because Hinduism is not really Avodah Zarah. He doesn't deal with Hinduism, but I guess he would say the same thing like Christianity. It's Shituf. So that's his justification. When we're going to stop now. We still need to look at a few more of his halachic justifications. So his limud schos, consider the question, is he a serious posek? Can a serious posek really come to these conclusions? Then I want to speak about some of what he writes about Morocco, the culture of Morocco, his involvement in the great dispute over Rav Kook. I think we have one more class of Rav Yosef Mesas. In fact, next week will be the last class of the semester, because 2 weeks from today, I will, God willing, be in Prague planning our wonderful trip, Torah in Motion trip, that final details will be announced soon. That is price. So we have one more class with Rav Mesas, and then I hope, God willing, that we'll finish this semester. So we'll talk more next week. We'll pick up following that when I return with the Stipler, Rav Meir Simcha, and then move into the Chasam Sofer. Shlomo, you asked me about the Buddha. I think you mean Buddhism is not Avodah Zarah. I mean, classic Buddhism is atheistic. Some developments of Buddhism, let's say the Dalai Lama, Tibetan Buddhism, like, they speak about, well, even them don't speak about gods, and they speak about spirits or beings. The question is, what is Avodah Zarah? What is it? According to some explanations, Avodah Zarah means you posit different gods of equal level in heaven. However, if you posit that there is a supreme god and subsidiary gods, that's what we call shituf, which we discussed a lot. That means that there's associationism. So when the Christians say there's the Father and then there's other gods, that's actually different. The Christians assume they're all equal, but they assume that there's one god. But even if you say there's lots of gods, if you assume that there's a supreme god and there's just little gods, in what sense are these little gods really gods? Why is this Avodah Zarah for non-Jews? I don't know if historically this is correct, because ancient pagan society, Greek society, did believe that you had Zeus, who was the supreme god, and then you had all sorts of little gods, and Chazal always assumed that this was real Avodah Zarah. Yet that viewpoint is found, that you have to have really alternate deities in heaven. I don't know if Buddhism, even the more quasi-idolatrous forms of Buddhism, fit into that category. They don't really believe in supreme gods. Even those who think that the Buddha becomes some sort of god, what does that mean, Avodah Zarah? I mean, they don't believe that he's creator of the world. They don't believe anything like that. They believe that the man, Buddha, he reached such a high level that he became a god. But what is a god? A god just means a perfected human. The technical term is a bodhisattva. When you become a bodhisattva, you assume this state where you achieve complete godliness, I guess. And then when you leave this world, you become a god, as it were. But in what sense are you a god? You're not a creator being like that. Just a superman. So I don't know. I've never learned Avodah Zarah in detail, and I don't think any of the poskim have ever really explained what Avodah Zarah is in relation to contemporary religions. That was one of the problems when the Indian hair issue broke. None of these rabbis understood what Hinduism is. They didn't know what to make of that religion. Is this idolatry? Is it not idolatry? They had to ask Nathan Katz, a scholar of Hindu traditions in Florida. So it would be nice to have a text that really discussed in detail and practiced. It's true, when you go to India and you see all these statues and idols, it certainly looks like idolatry. But yet, if you actually understand the theology of Hinduism, they do not believe in gods. They believe in one god with different manifestations. Really, that's no different than Christianity. So I do not know if there are any religions today that really fall, any mainstream religions, we fall under the categories of idolatry, Avodah Zarah of the rabbis. Partly because I'm not really sure, I don't know how much the rabbis knew about the other religions, and I don't know what the rabbis regarded as Avodah Zarah. I think the rabbis regarded any foreign worship as Avodah Zarah. But once you start to define this in medieval times, when you're dealing with Christianity, if Christianity is let off the hook, and is not regarded as Avodah Zarah, I'm not really sure what is Avodah Zarah. Obviously, the Meiri's understanding of Avodah Zarah is if you're an evil person. But what is theological Avodah Zarah? For the Rambam, it's obvious if you have a conception of different deities. But if you have the Tosafist notion, Christianity, at least how it's understood by Noda Behuda and others, and the Ramah, if you have the Tosafist understanding that non-Jews are allowed to have multiple manifestations of God, then it becomes much harder to explain what is idolatry. And if you say, okay, well, multiple gods is idolatry, let's say you have a supreme god and subsidiary gods. What's the definition of a god? Maybe these subsidiary gods are more like angels. And if you say you bow to statues, well, if you bow to a statue, and you don't think the statue is God. If you look in the Tanakh and you see descriptions in the Midrash, it seems that the pagans they're referring to thought that they really thought that the statues were God. So if the statues are just a representation of God, and even if in Hinduism the God assumes a presence in the statue, but why should that be any different than God assuming a human presence? If Christians get let off being idolaters, and they think that God assumes human form, the incarnation, then if you think that God assumes a manifestation in a statue, why is that any different? I don't have the answers to these questions. And Moshe Halbertal has a book on this topic, idolatry. It is very complicated once you assume that Christianity is not idolatry for non-Jews. I don't know really then what is idolatry for non-Jews, other than assuming maybe like an old Zoroastrian religion in which you have a god of light and a god of darkness and they're fighting with each other and they are each supreme beings. I don't know what else really qualifies. I understand they have a prayer room with statues and they bring them presents, but you have to understand, and that's why everyone assumed all of this. Rabbi Dunner, he goes to India and he sees them cutting their hair off and offering his hair to the statue. And he says, oh, it's idolatry. It's an idolatrous offering. And yet, all the experts, including many poskim, when it was explained to them, they said, no, it's not idolatry. They're not offering it to the statue. They're placing it there. And the offering is an offering of themselves to show that they give of themselves. But they're not actually giving anything. It's not like they're giving food to the god. So if you have a statue and you're really offering part of yourself to show that you are humbling yourself for the god, that offering, an offering to the god, no, it's removing something from yourself. I'll give you an example. The Jains, have you heard of the Jain religious tradition, J-A-I-N, they have statues, and they have all sorts of offerings. They have fruit and other offerings at the feet of the statue. And if you saw that, if you went to India and saw that, you'd say these are obviously idolaters. And yet they do not believe in God. They are an atheistic religion. They do not believe in a deity. And yet they bring offerings to statues. Because they believe that in doing that, they better themselves. When you say eat, what do you mean eat? And even if you say, what do you mean eat? They believe that they do believe that the god is present in the statue. But so what if the god is present in the statue? Why can't the supreme god? Are we saying that that's now idolatry? That the supreme god assumes a form on earth? If that's the case, then the Christianity is idolatry, and the Rambam thought so. The problem is, as I just mentioned, Sakh in the Shulchan Aruch of Ashkenazim, of the Ramah, Ramosha Israelis, is that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf, in associationism, and Christianity is not idolatry to non-Jews. And what could be more idolatrous than believing that God assumes human form? What could be more idolatrous than worshipping a human being? And yet, the Ashkenazic Pesach, back to the Tosafos, is that since they believe in a supreme deity, and this is only a manifestation or a part of the supreme deity, it is not idolatry. Does it make sense? Is it correct? That's not for me to say. What I can say, however, is that the standard Ashkenazic Pesach is that Christianity is not idolatry, is not Avodah Zarah for Gentiles, and if Christianity is not Avodah Zarah for Gentiles, Hinduism is not. And you don't take my word for it. The chief rabbinate of Israel, I can send anyone who's interested, came out with a statement. Rav Shar Yashav Cohen was the sitting leading rav on this. Daniel Sperber was one of the rabbis also, because he has a lot of involvement in India. And their ruling, they affirmed that Hinduism is not Avodah Zarah. This was important for the Indians to hear. They wanted to hear this. Why? Because they see Israel as in line with them in their battle against Pakistan. They think they were very insulted when all the Indian hair stuff came about, because they're adamant that they are monotheists. So to have the chief rabbinate affirm that the Hindus are monotheists was important for them. And if you want to know, how could they be monotheists? How could we regard them as monotheists? That is, as people who do not worship Avodah Zarah, not monotheists by our strict standard, but as far as what non-Jews are obligated in, we regard them as monotheists. If you ask me how that is the case, the answer is because of Shituf. And if you can explain Shituf, then you can explain Hinduism, and you can explain, as far as I know, all the religions. So it's a holdover from idolatry. I won't deny that, but that's neither here nor there, because it isn't idolatry. The fact is that the Jains are not worshipping an idol. They're simply putting fruit next to a statue. I could put fruit next to a statue. There's no prohibition in that, unless I'm putting it there as a form of worship. But if I just want to put my lunch down next to the statue of George Washington, or of Abraham Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial, because I want to start eating, there's no prohibition in that. So it doesn't matter if it's a holdover. No, Yisrael. What do you say? That's not true at all. There's two approaches. There's the approach that's the Avodah Zarah, and then there's the approach that it's Shituf. And non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. And then the question is, what does that mean, non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf? That's what Tosfos says. There's a machlokus about this. Some say that, Rabbi Yehuda says, it doesn't mean that they're not obligated in Shituf. What it means is that when they take an oath, there's no prohibition in us causing them to take an oath on Jesus and on God. But they are forbidden to have this belief. And then there's the other view, the view of the Ramosha Israelis, and obviously Hoffman and others, that non-Jews are not obligated in this pure belief about God. In fact, I asked David Berger, I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog, I asked David Berger at a debate we had about Chabad, actually, debate on how to relate to Chabad. I asked him the following question, because then we got into the issue of idolatry. David Berger believes that the Note of Yehuda is right, and the Ramah, Ramosha Isolus, is wrong. David Berger, as a great medieval historian, believes that Tosfos thought that Christianity was a real Avodah Zarah. And when the Tosfos says that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf, and therefore we could go into a business partnership with them where they take an oath on the name of their gods, that we can do this because there's no prohibition on Shituf, it only means in the context of an oath. But Tosfos still believes that it's forbidden for non-Jews to believe in Jesus. He thinks that's the historically accurate reading. So I asked David Berger, is it an authentic position to say that I think personally the Note of Yehuda is right? However, since the Ramah is the posik for Ashkenazic Jewry, and his psak appears in the Shulchan Aruch, and all the Ashkenazic posking afterwards other than Note of Yehuda have basically adopted the Note of Yehuda's position, you have W.C. Hoffman and so many others, is it intellectually honest to say, I think the Note of Yehuda is correct, but in terms of practical halacha, I will follow the Ramah that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf? David Berger, in his opinion, it is intellectually consistent and honest to say that although intellectually I think the Ramah is wrong, in terms of practical halacha, I will follow his position, because after all, the Ramah is the posek, not me, even though I think he's wrong. Yisrael, your explanation that they do it to bring success, I don't know what you mean to their hair salon. There's this huge temple in India where they all cut their hair off and then they offer it. And the reason given was it is not an offering to the god as if the god takes it or needs it. It's a way of showing their their obedience. That's the explanation that was given by all the experts. Even though some of the masses might think, that is the simpletons, might think they're giving it as an offering, most of the post-scheme said, we don't listen to what the fools, the ignorant people say. We go by what the experts in Hinduism say and how they explained it. And most post-scheme who wrote on this, not Rabbi Elyashiv, but most post-scheme who wrote on this concluded that there is no Avodah Zarah, and that it was permissible, and that this rabbi was given false information. Again, Yisrael, but why should it matter? If you believe that non-Jews have to have a pure belief in God, then it doesn't matter if it's two gods or 10 gods, or nice gods or nasty gods. more than one god makes you an idolater. And that's what the Rambam says. But if you assume that a non-Jew could have division of that, especially if you're dealing with Hinduism, there's one god with many manifestations. Every Hindu will tell you they believe in one god, that it shouldn't matter. I mean, if you want to find me a religion that believes in different divinities, but then you raise the other question. What does it mean, divinities? Are we really speaking about divinities? Or are we speaking about angel? What's the definition of a divinity versus an angel? Judaism a polytheistic religion because we believe in angels? These are sort of divine beings? And if you say, well, no, because the angels don't have supreme authority. Only God has supreme authority. Well, in ancient pagan religions, the gods didn't have supreme authority either. They only had partial authority. Zeus didn't have supreme authority. Mercury didn't have supreme authority. So all I'm saying is it's complicated. And we need someone who really knows these religions to write a sefer explaining, not explaining the old way. Rambam's position is very simple. But once you assume that there's shituf, and that's a permissible viewpoint, then explaining what does Avodah Zarah then mean? Is there such a thing as Avodah Zarah today? And if not, in history, really, what would qualify as Avodah Zarah? Give me a religion that would really qualify. Or is it the case that really we have to fall back on the Meiri's position that theologically that's really not the issue? It's all that these were evil people. I don't know. What is the difference that they are commanded the Gezerah is that we shouldn't be like them? No, I'm speaking about something else entirely. When we deal with Bishul Akum, we're not supposed to associate with them, so we don't marry them. But Shituf is the theological question. Are non-Jews obligated in a belief in one God, the way we are? Or can they have a more expansive view? And there would be practical implications. If you're speaking to a non-Jew, and he's willing to become a Noahide of sorts, you have to tell him that he has to reject his belief in Jesus, or would that be permissible belief for him? We'll see next class what Rabbi Messas says about Christianity. You were in an Asian store that just proved... Okay, two things. First of all, you might have a distinction here between the masses and the elites. The masses think all sorts of things. How much do we need to consider what the masses think? But second of all, so what? So the God consumes... Why do you assume that that necessarily means you're idolatrous? Remember the story I told you where the Jew in Tzfat, he would offer his challah every Shabbos to God. God would eat it. Well, God would eat it. Really, the Shamas would come into shul and see this and then take it. And when the rabbi saw what this guy was doing, he was a former Murano from Portugal, and he probably had some sort of Eucharistic mentality, yelled at him and said he's an idolater, and the Ari told this rabbi that that since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, God has not had as much hana'a from this poor, ignorant Jew every Shabbos, leaving him some challahs of bread. That is, even though this Jew was wrong, and was doing something that you might say is idolatrous, he had a pure intention. And the Ari said to this rabbi, because of you destroyed my Hana, God's Hana, you will die. And so this rabbi died. This story is recorded by Rav Moshe Chagiz and in the Ela Mitzvot. So it's also recorded by Rav Arola Roth, who's as extreme as you can get. In fact, this is a blatant rejection of the Rambam's fourth principle of faith, third principle of faith, that is the belief that you must believe in divine incorporeality, or else you're a heretic. Here we have Rav Arora Roth saying, if you don't know any better, for Bishogeg, you're not a heretic. Here the Ari was saying, this person's not an idolater, he doesn't know any better. So you could say the same thing about this woman. She doesn't know any better. In other words, why do you assume just because you give an offering that you think the God eats it, that that's idolatry? Because the God eats it? If you can say that a man God, that God is walking around in human form, and you say that that's not idolatry for the Gentiles, Jesus also ate. So that God eats, that's idolatry? It doesn't follow. So the justification for no bishalakum is that we'll associate with them. We'll become friendly with them. That's the justification given for it. My argument is a bit like Bill Clinton. It might be a bit like Bill Clinton, but the point is, my argument is not my argument. It's the argument of all the Ashkenazic poskim that say Christianity is not a avodah zarah for non-Jews. It's shittuf. And if you say that Christianity is shittuf, it follows inexorably that Hinduism is shittuf, as the chief rabbinate ruled. And the question, therefore, is not what religion is shittuf. The question is, which religion is not shittuf? Because it seems that basically every religion you could think of falls into the category of shittuf. So fine, you have a Shaila, you have a Kasha on the Ramah, and a Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, and a Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, and all the rest of them. Because what religion were the rabbis referring to then, when they spoke about Avodah Zarah? But then we also have an expression that you don't die from a Kasha. So yes, we have a question, but the fact is, you have to find your religion that differs inherently from Christianity, and then we could say that this is not just Shittuf, but it's real Avodah Zarah. And I do not know of any religions today that really fall under this. Look, if you don't want a Paskin like the Ramah, and you want to say Christianity is real Avodah Zarah, you don't have any of these problems. And yes, as far as Jews are concerned, it is Avodah Zarah. And we relate to it like Avodah Zarah. However, I'm talking about from the standpoint of the Gentile. Okay, unless we have any other questions. How about Zionism also Avodah Zarah? Yes. You are right. The Satmar Rav said that nationalism is Avodah Zarah. Don't you remember Yisrael when we did with Rishon Messas? He permitted a Jew to donate money to help build a church. As for the non-Jew, it is not Avodah Zarah. I work at a Catholic university. I see this up close. If you would go into a church and you'd see the worship and the rituals and the beliefs, from a Jewish perspective, this is real Avodah Zarah. And yet, so many poskim see otherwise. I don't know what to tell you other than that. Could be. The question is, you'd have to make the case. And if three gods don't make you Avodah Zarah, why do 1,000 gods make you Avodah Zarah? None of our early sources distinguish between 10 gods or 20 gods. With Hinduism, because remember, Hinduism thinks that they're all manifestations of the one God. So if you can have three manifestations, why can't you have 1,000 or 100,000? Look, if you don't buy it, what can I tell you? You have to then poskim like the Rambam. And I'm not saying that the Rambam's position doesn't make sense. Of course it makes sense. It's the Rambam. And I'm not saying that the Tosafos view, as explained by the Rambam, doesn't have problems. It has enormous problems. That's been the standard Ashkenazic psak for a few hundred years. Our job is to try to understand it and to see what the implications are. Reject it. If you want to be a post-sake, fine, reject it. I will tell you that certain Ashkenazic post-king do reject this. In those societies in which non-Jews oppress the Jews, that is, Gentiles oppress the Jews, you often find rabbis saying that Christianity is a real Avodah Zarah. But in those societies like Germany, before World War II, where the Jews were treated well and Jews and Gentiles got along, not surprisingly, the rabbis would say that it's not real Avodah Zarah. It's Shittuf. Okay, with that, it's already 10:30. Let's end. If you're still not satisfied, you want me to expand a little, send me some emails. But we will end here tonight. Thank you very much, everyone. Good night.